Thank you, Rabbi David, for being here this evening and gracing us with your presence on your way to the World Parliament of Religions beginning in Melbourne next week. You have often quoted Pope John Paul as a beloved elder brother in the Church. He spoke of being an elder brother of the original covenant, never broken and never to be broken. And so we welcome you as one of those people who belong to the elder brothers. In the spirit of brotherhood, of being together, of sharing together, as Professor Paul has said, as Christians, Jews and Muslims, and in that commitment to ongoing, particularly Jewish-Christian dialogue, it's in that spirit that we welcome you back to Wellington this evening. I think it was 8 years ago since you were here, but it's wonderful to have you with us, even if it is just a brief visit. I have the pleasure, too, obviously, of welcoming Rabbi Rosen as a papal knight. He was awarded a papal knighthood in 2005 for his contribution to promoting Jewish-Christian reconciliation, and in particular through the negotiations that led to the establishment of full diplomatic normalisation of relations between the State of Israel and the Holy See. So, congratulations on that knighthood. Rabbi Rosen, as many of you will know, is currently the director of the American Jewish Committee's Department for Religious Affairs in Jerusalem, is an international co-president of Religions for Peace, and a member of the Advisory Committee of the World Congress of Imams and Rabbis. To these and other responsibilities, he brings that incredible background and the experience of rabbinical service in South Africa and in Ireland. So he comes to us with a great experience. I'd like to just recall briefly again the words of Pope John Paul. He spoke of and said, "As the children of Abraham, we are called, Christians and Jews, to be a blessing to the world. In order to be such, we must first of all be a blessing to one another." And I think that that's a particularly apt description in relation to the topic that Rabbi Rosen will address this evening. Christians, Muslims and Jews in the Middle East. Is religion the problem or the solution? If we think of being a blessing to one another, we're obviously called to be a blessing to all people, whatever faith, whether it's Jewish, Muslim or Christian. Rabbi Rosen, thank you for being with us. Thank you for being prepared to spend time sharing with us this evening and opening up for us the reflections on how we can better be a blessing for one another in order to be that blessing for people of all religions and particularly to all who live in the Middle East. Please welcome Rabbi David.
Very much, Archbishop Duke. You don't need the microphone, do you? I'm projecting my voice adequately. Anybody dissatisfied? Yes? No? Good, thank you. So, thank you again, Archbishop Duke, for your very gracious introduction. It feels that I'm here also at an evening of the Council of Christians and you. See, that's rather bad. Interestingly enough, if you will permit me, I have far too many kippots, heads, skull caps for my own good, which I am collecting for the Day of Judgment when the Almighty asks to see what I have done in this world, hoping that it will stand me some good. But of course, one couldn't expect, and very thankful, that the introduction was not too long. But allow me just to mention one additional aspect within this context. The last time I was here, I was still the president of the International Council of Christians and Jews. Therefore, was here, if you like, as your president, if I may be so presumptuous. And now I'm just an honorary president kicked upstairs. But nevertheless, I do have that, if you like, institutional relationship with the framework in which this evening's event is taking place. So permit that acknowledgement. May I also remark that I wish to applaud and encourage you to move, in addition to the very special Jewish-Christian relationship, to encompass our Muslim brothers and sisters. I think that trilateral dialogue is especially important today. Of course, that's the more correct term, because trilogue is not the real word. Dialogue doesn't come from the Latin, but from the Greek, and therefore, dia there is not two, but dia through. Excuse me for that one. But I do think that the trilateral dialogue is enormously important. And in fact, after the parliament, I do some crazy things in terms of my international interreligious affairs, which I'm very privileged to be engaged in this work. My second daughter says when she talks of her father in heaven, she's not talking of the Almighty. It's me whizzing around somewhere out there. And I actually came in now. I left Jerusalem on Sunday, flew in for a meeting in Paris, and then via Hong Kong to Auckland, and spoke yesterday in Auckland, and on today here in Wellington, and on tomorrow to Sydney. But after the Parliament of the World Religions in Melbourne, I fly home and stay in the airport for 6 hours and then fly out to Spain. And the reason I'm telling you my travel itinerary is because I'm on to Spain to go to Seville, where we will be having the International Jewish Committee, which presumes to represent world Jewry in interreligious relations and is the official partner of the Vatican in of the Vatican's Commission for Religious Relations with the Jews, and technically also with the World Council of Churches and with the Orthodox Churches. This International Jewish Committee, together with the Vatican and the Orthodox Churches, will be having a trilateral dialogue with the World Muslim League from Saudi Arabia as the partner, hosted by the Center for the Three Cultures in Seville. And so that, I think, is another milestone and hopefully will bear good fruit for us all. But my mandate this evening is to speak about the context in which officially I live, even if the majority of time I'm not there. And the title begs, of course, a bigger question. So let me begin with that bigger question and then come to the specific context. But would be remiss, I have already been remiss, in not acknowledging the rabbi of the Jewish community here and Rabbi Dovrat and other members of the leadership of the different communities that give the variety and the beauty of religious diversity of the city. So I'm grateful to all of you who are here. The big question then is religion the problem or the solution? And that itself begs the question in many contexts which we look at today, especially in areas of conflict, where religion all too often seems to exacerbate, if not seriously compound, the difficulties of relationships between different people. The late Pope John Paul II, whom Archbishop Dew has referred to, said, "Violence in the name of religion is not religion." And I think that most of us would agree with that, that if religion is a source of violence, it actually betrays its true métier. But this still begs the question, why is it that religion seems to be at least all too easily exploited as a tool to exacerbate violence and even inspire it in certain contexts? And of course, there's more than one answer to this question, and there are various contextual differences. But I think that one of the most important dimensions to understand in order to address this challenge is the whole relationship between religion and identity. Religion, in essence, seeks to give meaning to our understanding of who we are. It is therefore bound up with all the components of human identity, from an individual, family, community, people, even humanity. These building blocks of our human identity are very crucial to our psycho-spiritual welfare. There are some people that think because there are divisions within the human family, it is best to try to ignore these or to reduce them to their lowest common denominator. You will be familiar with the words of the late John Lennon in his song Imagine, where he believes that if there were no countries and nothing to live and nothing to fight or die for, and no religion too, that would lead to a universe of humankind. And this facile perception has many adherents, but it is indeed a fallacy which at closer inspection we can see is in fact a very dangerous one, because trying to reduce all humanity to its lowest common denominator actually divests people of what makes them the human beings that they are, and the richness that makes them the people they are. In fact, today we can see, especially within modern Western secular society, what happens when people are deracinated, are rendered rootless in terms of their identities and affiliations, cultural, religious, even national. We see that people seek for some kind of meaning and purpose because they have lost that which nurtures and gives them meaning, which is the essence of religion. And so you have a proliferation of cults, of drug culture, even violent abuse, all of which is the search for stimulation on the part of those who sometimes are bored, but in most cases, just devoid of a sense of purpose and of meaning within their lives. And indeed, people who have been divested of their identities are those who are the easiest prey for all kinds of demagogues and for all kinds of cults that tend to sprout up in profusion within secular society. So the need to be able to nurture these building blocks of identity is very important. But there's the rub. Identity tells me who I am. It tells me also, by definition, who I am not. Now, telling me who I am not is not necessarily bad. As I say, on the contrary, as long as that understanding of who am I not does not lead me to any sense of superiority that leads to a kind of a derogation or in any a kind of disparagement towards another. So particularity is of great value if it expresses itself in a universal way. Indeed, getting back to John Lennon, I would say that the only way we can really construct a true brotherhood of humankind is if we respect the particularities of one another and see them as the diversity of different flowers that contribute to the beauty of the garden. And in fact, that is the only kind of universalism that will be sustainable when it is rooted in respect for those different particularities. But all too often, that understanding of who I am not, as I say, can lead to an insularity and can lead to a form of disparagement and even dismissal of the other. This is especially so in contexts of conflict, when identities feel threatened. And we know the relationship, the close proximity between the insecurity complex and the superiority complex. When people feel threatened, and they are not welcome, or may even be in physical danger, there is the tendency on their own part not only to enclose themselves and to isolate themselves, but also to tend to use their own identity as a form of self-righteousness, and not only to disparage the other, but often even to demonize the other. Because religion is bound up with identity, when identity feels threatened and isolates itself and withdraws, then all too often religion itself becomes part and parcel of that insularity and withdrawal. In fairness, it's not only in a negative sense. If you look at the prophets of Israel in the Hebrew Bible, you will see that the prophets are doing two essential things. One is they are challenging the people to be more expansive in their religiosity, to reach out to the orphan, to the widow, to the stranger, to the marginalized. And the other is to nurture the people and to give them a sense of hope and of faith and of confidence that they will be able to survive the difficulties and the challenges they face. But these are two messages in two very different contexts. The prophets challenge the people to be more expansive when they are living in the land and are secure. There they say, don't get fat, cat, and self-obsessed. Be more compassionate. Reach out to the other. They do not challenge the people to do that when they are vulnerable, when they are being expelled from their land, when they are in exile, where they don't know whether they will be able to survive until the next day. In that situation, to challenge them is almost obscene. In that situation, their role is to provide succor, is to provide support, is to provide faith, hope, and confidence in the future. And therefore, nurturing people's identity in a situation of conflict and tension is a very important thing. It's not something to be dismissive about. But nevertheless, if religion is only nurturing in that context, then all too often, again, it gets wrapped up in this process of withdrawal, of insularity, of isolation, of self-righteousness, and even of demonization of the other and dehumanization of the other. And that is when religion becomes part of the problem. So in essence to the question, religion is all too often part of the problem, but my message this evening is that religion has to be part of the solution. In the Middle East, the conflict, whether in the broader context of the Israeli-Arab conflict or in the more specific context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, is not a religious conflict. It's a territorial conflict. By way of illustration, in 1967, Gamal Abdel Nasser on the one side and Moshe Dayan or Levi Eshkol on the other did not go to war over theology. All of them were professed atheists. Their conflict was a territorial conflict. However, that conflict involves people with identities. And those identities are deeply rooted within different religious traditions and different narratives. And therefore, in situations of conflict, there is not only the tendency to call on these narratives by way of justification, but also the danger that they are used to engender a certain self-righteousness and even a demonization and dehumanization of the other. And that is when religion betrays its métier. Allow me to mention that in Israel there is a proliferation of interfaith activity. Probably nowhere in the world do you have as much interfaith activity as you have in Israel. We have an interreligious council that embraces over 75 different organizations working in relations between Jews, Christians, and Muslims, and Baha'i and Druze. And indeed, on a more general intercultural level, interethnic level, there are well over 150 organizations working in Jewish Arab relations, social, educational, philanthropic advocacy. An enormous variety. However, in all honesty, I have to say that all this activity, and significant activity, because it often involves multiplicators, representatives of churches, communities, academics, people who interact with very often thousands of pilgrims, nevertheless, for the majority of Israelis and Palestinians who live in the Holy Land, the vast majority have even no idea of its existence, let alone people in the world at large. 95% are totally untouched. This is the activity of a small, albeit significant, minority. And there are a number of different reasons for that. So one of the reasons has simply to do with the fact that life is tough for both Israelis and Palestinians. Mutatis mutandis, each one according to different circumstances. People have so many other preoccupations, as indeed political life is almost totally subsumed with the issue of the conflict, that many very important civic and civil issues tend to be pushed onto the back burner. But there is another aspect to it, and that is that the cultural mentality very often of religious institutions is not always the most advanced, and very often reflects mentalities that are not totally comfortable in the modern world. And therefore, to a degree, are already somewhat on the retreat or somewhat closing themselves up. And especially, as I say, in a context of conflict, this tends to be exacerbated. So the result is that all this interfaith work that I'm talking about tends to be carried out by people on the margins of their own particular religious community, on the fringes of their respective establishments. Indeed, not only on the fringes, but very often people who challenge their establishment or for whom their establishments don't feel comfortable with, they may even be red rags to their respective establishments. And therefore, as a result, the institutions themselves have not been engaged in interfaith relations. And there is the need to engage them. Because even if these establishments do not reflect the prophetic voice are challenging their respective institutions, political institutions above all. Nevertheless, they do represent the identities of the communities. And to ignore them is a serious error. And indeed, it is that error that politicians and diplomats have made in the past. Perhaps most illustrative of this are the Oslo Accords themselves. The peace process initiated by Yitzhak Rabin and Yasser Arafat, whether intentionally or otherwise, disregarded the religious dimension and religious communities, overtly religious communities, altogether. On the lawn of the White House, when the famous handshake took place, there was no identifiable Palestinian religious leadership of any kind. There was no identifiable Israeli religious leadership of any kind. The message, as I say, implicit or even more, was, you religious people, keep out of this, because you're only going to mess things up with all the terrible things that are done in the name of religion. And I can understand that, because terrible things are done in the name of religion. But it's an absolute fallacy. Because like all aspects of nature abhorring a vacuum, if you don't put in one voice, then another voice is going to occupy it. And if you don't have the moderate voices, assuming center stage the extremist voices are going to do so alternatively. And indeed, whether it was Islamic Jihad or Hamas on the one hand, or whether it was Baruch Goldstein who murdered innocent Muslim worshippers at prayer at the Cave of Machpelah at the Ibrahimi Mosque, or Yigal Amir who assassinated Yitzhak Rabin, all of them believed that they were doing what God wanted them to do, because all of them, there was this conspiracy of extremists, believed that the peace process was against God's wishes, was against the interests of their respective religious communities. Unfortunately, that conspiracy of extremists still exists. Now, politicians have therefore tended to ignore that dimension and compound the problem, because ignoring it, and actually you invite the extremists to assume greater voice and greater centrality. If you don't want extremists to control the voice of religion, you have to make sure that the moderates are there. If you don't want religion to be part of the problem, you have to make sure that it's part of the solution. That's what has failed so far, and that is what really needs to be addressed. And I'm part of an initiative that I hope will bear fruit in that regard, though it takes time because these perceptions are so deeply ingrained and because these fears are so profound. At the height of the Second Intifada, an initiative was taken by the then Archbishop of Canterbury, Lord George Carey, and my colleague Rabbi Melchior, who was a Deputy Minister of Foreign Affairs, played a very important role in facilitating this process. But perhaps above all, we were able to take this initiative because we had the cooperation of the most important Muslim institution, arguably, in the whole Sunni Muslim world, Al-Azhar in Cairo. At the invitation of the head of Al-Azhar, Sheikh Sayed Mohammed Tantawi, we brought together for the first time ever in history the religious leaders of the Holy Land. From the chief rabbi, the Sephardic chief rabbi at that time of Israel, the head of the Sharia courts of the Palestinian Authority, patriarchs of Jerusalem, all in all, 15 from the three different religions gathered in Alexandria and signed a very historic declaration that declared that violence in the name of religion is a desecration of religion and called for peace and reconciliation. That was both wonderful and pathetic. I mean, it's pathetic that never before until 2002 had the religious leaders of the Holy Land ever come together. It's wonderful that we were able to do it. And it started something of an internal process, which has now led to the establishment of the Council of the Religious Institutions of the Holy Land. It's rather a mouthful, but it's an important name because it emphasizes that as opposed to Alexandria, the persons are not there just in their individual capacity, but represent the institutions. And this is therefore the first structure of religious establishments that have come together expressively for the purpose of trying to promote peace. And it's made up of the Chief Rabbinate of Israel, of the Ministry of Awqaf, the Ministry of Religious Affairs of the Palestinian Authority, the Sharia Courts of the Palestinian Authority, and all the patriarchs and bishops of the Holy Land, all together, meeting regularly, not necessarily all the upper hierarchy, but mostly and always with representation of the upper hierarchy. And this council has three express purposes. One is to keep open avenues of communication between the religious leadership. The second is to help fight incitement and defamation, misrepresentation of any one of the three, to do it together. And there is now an initiative for the first time, which the council is sponsoring the first joint and objective study of educational materials in both Palestinian and Israeli curricula and how the other is presented. This is being done together with Tel Aviv University, with Bethlehem University, with Syracuse University, and Association of International Academic Scholars assessing and reviewing and commenting on the material. But finally, the third goal is expressly, declaredly by all the religious leaders, to help promote peace in the Middle East, to support any initiative to bring about an end and resolution of the conflict in which two nations can live together side by side. Obviously, the different religious leaders do not have exactly the same vision of what the end game is or even of what the process is to be able to get there, but all of them expressively want that situation of an end to violence, of promotion of human dignity, of peace and of tranquility, and of prosperity for all the people there. For them it's obvious, but if you talk around the world, most people don't think it is. Most people are convinced that those religious leaders not only don't meet with one another, but don't really want the other to exist, and doing everything they can to prevent the existence of the other. But in reality, all of them want to live in peace. And even if they are not all interfaith protagonists, nor let alone individuals with interfaith experience, nevertheless, their role in being able to nurture a different climate of attitudes and of a different approach is crucial. Indeed, I would go so far as to say any political initiative will only succeed if they take the religious dimension seriously. Religion in the Middle East, interfaith relations, cannot bring about a solution in itself. However, no solution will come to the Middle East with all its implications, not only for the region, but for the globe, for humanity, until political leadership understands the importance of this religious dimension, and until these structures and opportunities for interfaith collaboration and support are seriously engaged. So again, allow me to repeat. Interfaith relations will not bring in itself a resolution to the conflict in the Middle East. But no resolution will succeed if it does not take the interfaith dimension seriously. So allow me to conclude, ladies and gentlemen, by telling you that that in all my peregrinations, because I am my salary is paid by an American Jewish organization, I am in the States very often and discover that despite my accent, the cutting edge of the English language, where new words are being innovated all the time, is in the United States. And recently I was introduced, and there I discovered new words, and recently I was introduced as a well-known dialogian. I had never heard this word, dialogian. They explained to me it means a theologian who's involved in dialogue is a dialogian. Okay, but my experience is most dialogians are in fact monologians. And I would like now to prove to you that I'm a dialogian by bringing my monologue to an end and thanking you for listening and handing over to His Grace the Archbishop to chair the next part of the evening.
Ladies and gentlemen, Rabbi Rosen said he was happy to take questions for as long as we had questions to ask. But once we've heard his punishing travel schedule, I'm sure we don't want to be here all night. Our dialogue is happy to answer any questions that we might have. So if you'd like to direct those questions to Rabbi Rosen.
Yes, thanks very much for your very eloquent talk. It seems to me that you're suggesting that there needs to be more communication with the political and the theological. What is happening in that area?
So in order to be able to get our message across, we have been trying to engage political leadership as much as possible. And the council has had meetings with Tony Blair, with the President of the Council of Europe, with Condoleezza Rice, has been hosted also by Tzipi Livni when she was a foreign minister and has very much the blessing and support of Abu Mazen. But even if politicians understand that there is value to it, they still have not really understood the way in which they need to engage it. But even more than that, until there is some kind of real political initiative, then that engagement doesn't really have the significance it needs to have.
Indeed, one can say that about all the interfaith activity we have. If we're really honest, for as long as the conflict prevails, all the activity we are engaged in is damage control. Or, at least, it's testimony. Or, if you want, it's preparation for the morning after, when a resolution to the conflict comes about. But the importance of engaging this institution is when there is some process taking place. At the moment, there doesn't seem to be much process taking place for a variety of different reasons, and I wouldn't put the blame entirely at anybody's door, even though I'm not suggesting it's necessarily totally equally divided either. But nevertheless, it's important, therefore, to engage political leadership so that when that moment comes, there will be the opportunity to engage it. Nevertheless, most societies are parochial, and our society is no different in that regard. And therefore, one of the most important things we did, which last year, we took the two chief rabbis, the Ashkenazi and Sephardi chief rabbi, the head of the Sharia courts and the head of the Ministry of Awqaf for the Palestinian Authority, the two most important sheikhs, two patriarchs, two bishops, now I'm going to think I'm going to say and a partridge in a pear tree, but a gathering of us, I think we were about a dozen, to Washington, where we met with the members of the Senate and of the Congress and in the State Department, all to try to get that message across. I actually think we were doing quite a good job with the last administration. Despite, the interesting thing is, I think, especially with Condoleezza Rice, I must, from a partisan point of view, can't say that I had the same degree of respect for her boss that I had for her. But I think she understood it, and were there to have been some particular movement, I think we could have maybe got somewhere. I'm a little bit distressed at the moment. We don't seem to have got our message through to the present administration, where I have much greater esteem for the individual at the top of the pyramid. But there does not seem to have yet been that engagement, but yet there doesn't seem to have been any particular development anyway. So this is, we have to do this more, but as I say, societies are parochial. The more Israeli and Palestinian leadership see that American leadership takes us seriously, the more they will take us seriously. And therefore, that's where we need to be able to work on that access more, and that's what we're trying our best to do.
Thank you. I want to add something to Rabbi Rosen. In Bar-Ilan University, 5 years ago, I think white plantation agreement between Eric Sharon and President Clinton, a course, a seminar for a year for teachers, religious teacher from Israel and Muslim people in Bar-Ilan to meet, to engage in meeting seminars, and the top of this, after a year of meetings, to go to overseas to Turkey and to be outside Israel for a week, and the people who did it twice, they enjoyed it very much. In the year that I was part of this course in Bar-Ilan 5 years ago, 3 times we wanted to meet. And something happened. If it's killing Yassin, or the second time we wanted to meet, it was the day before a bus was blown, and that's upset the whole people, and we canceled the meeting. So that is the problem. We wanted the teachers from both sides, we have a meeting, but after a bomb or after a murder or a terrorist attack, both sides of people don't feel comfortable to go to meet the enemy, to speak with them.
Yeah, thank you. It's an important illustration of the part of the challenge, and to emphasize that we are talking about in our sense of traumatized communities, each with their different traumas, but nevertheless each very profound, and in which religious leadership must respond to the trauma of their own community. And that's the challenge of being able to respond and yet at the same time ask them to reach out and beyond is not a simple expectation.
Thank you. Other questions?
There are political dimensions to the religions that are operating in the area. And how would you get, for example, Shas to sit down with Hamas?
That's actually much easier in certain respects than because... interestingly enough, the ultra-Orthodox parties are not ideological parties in a political sense, but only in a sectorial sense. And therefore, to get the ultra-Orthodox parties to be pragmatic is not difficult if they get their slice of the fiscal cake.
It's much more difficult with those that actually have an ideology that prevents them from being able to engage in the potentiality of compromise. And that is more actually with religious Zionism than it is with ultra-Orthodoxy. But in the end, human beings are not lemmings. And in the end, I believe that all the communities would prefer to find the most effective way to advance their interests without going for bust. Of course, they will try to push things to their maximal advantage as much as they can, but when the writing is the wall, they will actually respond. Now, for example, for religious Zionism, the evacuation from Gaza was an enormous trauma, and there were those that opposed it. But the vast majority of their leadership said, if this is the political decision, if this is the national decision, then we must not go against the wishes of our nation, of its leadership, and certainly not of its security forces. And therefore, with a great deal of angst and distress, the majority of religious Zionism accepted that decision. The real issue, I think, is not the incapacity to overcome ideological or religious positions, as much as the broader question of trust. Especially after the Second Intifada, there is a breakdown of trust between Palestinians and Israelis. And in fact, that breakdown of trust is worse than it was before the Oslo process, because had there been no expectations built up, okay, there would be some that would say, yes, it's worthwhile taking a chance, other than say no. But when your expectations have been raised and then have been dashed, then your attitude towards the possibilities is even more skeptical, and your position is even more depressed and often highly traumatized. From an Israeli point of view, the Second Intifada was an enormous, not just disappointment, but trauma. Walking in the streets, not knowing whether you were alive today or tomorrow, whether your children could go anywhere, with absolute carnage every single moment, it convinced the vast majority of Israelis that there's no real desire on the part of Palestinian society to live in peace with Israeli society. For Palestinians, Israeli reaction to what they saw for the vast majority was peaceful protest, and with only, in their eyes, a fringe element being violent, was so overwhelmingly total on the whole population, and that they felt, coming down on a nut with a sledgehammer, that they feel that it's proven that Israel doesn't really want to live in mutual respect with Palestinians. And the loss of trust on both sides is so profound that today the vast majority of Israelis say, look, to ask us to take a risk and to be able to give up a certain amount of territorial protection in order for the possibility that Palestinians may give up violence after what we've experienced is just suicidal, it's crazy. Of course, the other half of Israeli society is saying it might be very risky, but if we don't take that risk in the end, we may not have anything to be able to compromise on. And therefore, we have to do whatever we can in order to be able to take that risk in as well protected a manner as possible. That is more the real debate within Israel, as to whether it's possible, advisable, or prohibited to take a risk. And there, you will find that religion, again, will bolster its various arguments to support one position or the other. Because religion in itself is not an ideological statement with regard to political operation. Even those for whom, and I would put myself amongst them, Israel is a fulfillment of prophetic vision, is a sign of divine fidelity, is of enormous religious significance, don't believe the vast majority of us that that means that we can abdicate our pragmatic responsibilities, political, economic, social, and moral. And therefore, to find some way of compromise, if it's possible, is in fact an imperative. So the real debate that's dividing us is whether now is the moment when we can get there or not yet.
Towards the beginning, you said that in the Six-Day War, the problem was a territorial problem between secularists. Could you comment on the theory that the actual territorial problem is a religious problem, and that the Muslim ideal is that the land should not and could not be anything but a Muslim state?
So let me say that until, for the vast majority of the history of this conflict, the religious arguments have not been the major arguments that have been used in the context of the conflict. The mainstream religious Zionist community that saw and sees the re-establishment of Israel as indeed part of age-old expectation having been realized, did not use this argument as the basis for avoiding any kind of peaceful resolution. It was still seen essentially as a territorial conflict. Similarly, for the majority of the history, even those with speaking in religious language from the Muslim world, did not use the argument of Dar al-Islam versus Dar al-Harb, the term that you used of the world of Islam versus the world of the sword, but mainly used the language of dispossession of Palestinians, of the question, therefore, of rights and of dignity of Palestinians within that particular context, maybe even sometimes broader questions within their broader vision of the international forces that were responsible for the way things have developed. But that language that you talk about now has become commonplace. And this is the real danger, and this allows me actually to add a phrase that I had meant to put in my presentation that I left out. And that is that what's happened is that a territorial conflict has become religionized. And that is a very difficult and dangerous process, because for as long as this is a territorial conflict, then you can find a territorial solution. But if you see or portray this as the war of the godly and the goodly against the godless and the evil, then you're condemning us to indefinite bloodshed without any possible resolution in sight. And that's why it's so important to engage religion in this process, because that process that you're talking about is happening. And for as long as the conflict continues, it's going to increase. And whereas 20 years ago, if you would have gone into the Muslim world in this part of the world, in Southeast Asia, or even in Europe and but beyond the Arab world, you would not have heard the conflict in the Middle East portrayed as a conflict between Islam and Judaism. That is a very recent development. And it is a development, and where I'm able to travel in the Arab world, I travel quite a bit in the Arab world. As in addition to my Israeli passport, I have a British passport. And in fact, I was due to be in Dubai at this time, but God made the commitment to be here, so I'm not in Dubai. And I was for a meeting that actually, second meeting of one that I had been at last year. And in the Muslim world, there is a perception that not only that the heart of the conflict is religious, but that the focus of religiosity of Islam in the Holy Land, the holy sites on the Temple Mount, the Haram al-Sharif, are genuinely in jeopardy by evil Israeli intent that wants to destroy them. And when I tell my Muslim friends that, in fact, those who may harbour such attitudes are a tiny fringe element in Israeli society, and the vast majority of religious leadership is totally opposed to any kind of violent behaviour, more than that, the official position of the chief rabbinate of Israel is that Jews are not allowed to go onto the Temple Mount, and there are signs all around there telling Jews not to go. This next phrase is going to sound strange to many of you. Thank God, Israel is not a theocracy, but a secular democracy, and people do not have to listen to what rabbis tell them. That may sound very strange coming from a rabbi, but I don't want to live in a society where you have to listen to what rabbis tell you. I want to live in a society where people choose by their own volition to live a certain way. And therefore, I actually believe that religion is healthy, much healthier in secular democracy than in any other form of context. But therefore, people are able to be able to move and to go as tourists onto the Temple Mount. But if they start to pray, long before the Muslim guards of the Waqf, the religious authority, will haul them off, the Israeli police will have already hauled them off. And when I tell my Muslim friends, in the Arab world in particular, about these facts on the ground, they think I'm just telling them stories. They don't believe it. Because they have been now fed such information that they really feel that there is a threat to Muslim sites, Israeli intent is evil, and that the source of Israel's hostility, in their perception, is religious. That Jews and Judaism are hostile to Islam and Islamic interests. And you will all be very familiar with the counterbalance to that. The counterbalance which is now widespread, widespread attitude amongst Palestinians, let alone the Muslim world, that there never ever was a temple, that Jews don't have any historical relationship to that piece of territory, that all these Jewish stories are an invention just to dispossess the Palestinians. It's all a fabrication, and there's absolutely no basis to it whatsoever. Therefore, how do Jews feel in that regard? They feel that there's a real threat, a real rejection of their own attachments, their own identity, and that it's based on religion, and that it's coming from Islamic teaching. And this is a really dangerous development. And that's why it's more urgent than ever before that religious leaders are seen to be able not only to meet with one another, but to declare together, we want to live together in peace. Our religions are not the source of this conflict and are not the basis for any kind of enmity or conflict between each other. Yes, please.
I would appreciate your comments on the idea of Jerusalem as an international city.
Thank you. Well, while the idea of the internationalization of Jerusalem was the original plan recommended by the United Nations in 1947, which Israel accepted, actually, but the Arab nations rejected and then went to war, leading to Israel's War of Independence, by now, nobody, to the best of my knowledge, certainly no public figure in Israeli or Palestinian society, thinks that the internationalization of Jerusalem is the solution. And even the Vatican, which for many years did talk of Jerusalem as a corpus separatum, as a separate entity, no longer talks in that language, because the Vatican has both established treaties with Israel and with the Palestinian Authority, and in which all it's asking for is that there should be some international support and guarantees for the preservation of holy sites in Jerusalem. Now, this then begs the question, why is there no support for the internationalization of Jerusalem? In most cases, because both Palestinians and Israelis want to have a resolution that is going to respect their own particularities, getting back to what I was speaking about in the first place. And therefore a perception that it's possible to do that without needing to internationalize the city. And indeed, if there is peace, then a solution for Jerusalem is by no means difficult to be able to conceive. There is absolutely no reason why you can't have one municipality. You could have two municipalities, two states, but I think one would be preferable, and I'll explain why in a moment for very prosaic reasons, in which you have residents of Jerusalem who are both Palestinian citizens and are part of a Palestinian state in terms of their own citizenship, and who are also made up of Israelis who are Israeli citizens in terms of their citizenship. It should be possible to be able to do that, and therefore internationalization itself should not be necessary if there is peace between Israelis and Palestinians. But the other, perhaps most prosaic and perhaps most compelling reasons is that you need people to operate basic services. There are services of water, of sewage, of garbage collection. There are obviously questions of security and maintenance of law and order and of police forces. And being able to do that through the local resources made up of the respective communities is probably going to be more effective and is much more practical in terms of the way services should be provided. It will probably be a much better solution for Jerusalem to decentralize government as possible as much to boroughs, so that different neighborhoods will have greater responsibilities for their own affairs. So I'm not sure that the issue is so much one of principle today as much a question of pragmatism, that there are better ways to address the future of Jerusalem in a context of peace rather than its internationalization.
Question.
Could you also make some comments about the position of the West Bank settlements and the various parties' policies towards them in this territorial dispute?
The vast majority of Israelis and probably of Palestinians, according to surveys, know that if there is genuine will and capacity, it's not just will, it's also capacity to be able to deliver on both sides, that the parameters of a peace solution are more or less along the lines outlined by President Clinton at Camp David. This will mean that there would need to be border changes on the 67 lines that could incorporate the vast majority of towns and settlements that have been established over the Green Line, that means beyond the borders of the 1948 borders, and that in exchange for incorporating those as part, as they are contiguous with the Green Line, and therefore you just extend the borders of Israel to include them, there will be a land swap of equal quality, and an area either from the north of Israel or from the south of Israel would be part and parcel of the Palestinian state. Then comes the question, in a peace agreement, and this is all hypothetical, on the assumption that we can get there and that it can be delivered. In such a situation, we are dealing with only, and I say only, even though for one person this is still going to be traumatic, 60,000 people who are outside those parameters. So 60,000 people in areas dotted around the West Bank. Now, in the same way as it was traumatic to relocate from Gaza, it is possible to do a traumatic relocation from the West Bank of those communities. Obviously, a much more preferable solution would be to have a peace agreement in which people do not have to evacuate from those particular communities, in which if there is proof of the fact that some of those are built on private land, individuals can be compensated. The vast majority are built on what's called state lands, which had no private ownership, and therefore need to be some form of compensation to a Palestinian state. And that if those people chose, they could continue to live there under Palestinian government. And that if they chose not to, they could be compensated and relocated. All of this is not beyond, we're not talking of rocket science here. It's not in any way beyond the bounds of possibility and of practicality, if there is the will and the capacity to be able to deliver on the resolution. And that's the big if.
One last question, thank you.
In 1990, there was Elston Village destroyed by New Zealand soldiers.
Could you speak up again a little louder, please?
Sorry. In 1980, there was a Palestinian village that was destroyed by New Zealand soldiers. The New Zealand government and the Australian government actually provided compensation for the destruction of that village and for the death of all the men in that village. Would you envisage that the state of Israel would do the same for those villages that were destroyed in 1948?
Thank you. I didn't know about that, and that's very interesting. And I would say any kind of welfare, compassion, and practical assistance to victims of any suffering, pain, expulsion, and destruction is wonderful, and I applaud the New Zealand government for having done that. It would have been even nicer if they would offer the same kind of response to Jews who were the victim of the massacre in Hebron just about a decade later, or actually in the 30s, which were almost entirely wiped out as a result of the conflict with Palestinians. But nevertheless, any kind of respect and compassion for those who are the victims of violence is very, very important. Okay, so I was going to come to that as well. In the broader context, we are dealing with enormous, not just immediate traumatic experiences of people in the immediate context, but experiences that go way beyond it. Jews in Arab lands who were expelled, whose properties were confiscated, and therefore in the context of any kind of broader compensation should be taken into account in terms of the broader Israeli-Arab conflict, of all those countries that have been involved in a conflict, and of all of them taking responsibility for it. However, Israel has always said that if the Arab world will make peace with it, it needs to work together with the international bodies to provide compensation for those Palestinians who lost their homes and their properties in that conflict. And the most important way to be able to address that is to work together with the Arab governments to enable those Palestinians who are often maintained in a state as Palestinian refugees to be integrated within the communities they live. In Lebanon, if you are a Palestinian refugee, you cannot not only buy a home, you cannot own property, you cannot be permitted to enter into 52 categories of jobs in which Palestinians are outlawed, are prevented from being able to work in those areas. There are many similar restrictions in different Arab countries that have maintained the plight of the Palestinians as a political pawn for their own interests. If we are able to really do justice to those who have been the victims of this conflict, it's not only two ways, it's multi-party, with all those different parties being in it. But I am confident that in the context of a resolution, Israel will do its part to the very best of its ability to be able to ensure that as many victims as possible are compensated, that we find a way to be able to ensure that all those who have been displaced, distressed, and harmed, and indeed divested as a result of that conflict, are compensated and are facilitated to be able to live in dignity to the best of our ability. That is certainly the major moral challenge in the context of any kind of resolution of the conflict.
Thank you, Rabbi Rosen, for the way you've answered those questions. Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for the questions you've put to Rabbi Rosen this evening. We can see why you are in such high demand and travelling the world to various meetings and conferences and sharing the expertise and knowledge that you have. In order to thank you, I'd like to invite Reverend Jenny Chalmers from St. Mark's in Carterton, who's the Christian co-chair, along with Dave Moskowitz, the Jewish co-chair of the Council of Christians and Jews. I'd like to invite Jenny Chalmers to say thanks to you.
Rabbi David, thank you so much for that illuminating and wonderful talk, and thank you for taking questions on such a wide and interesting and varied scale. We've been waiting for a long time for you to come, and finally you've come, and it's been well worth the wait. Thank you.
Thank you.
Just before I sit, I wonder if I might crave your indulgence by acknowledging Rabbi Johanna, who is leaving us at the end of December. She is the immediate past president of the Wellington CCJ, and she's returning to the States, and this is her last public outing, really, with us. So, Johanna, we will miss you, and thank you for all that you have given us. And finally, Professor Paul Morris, thank you for your gift of having us here, for the gift of these wonderful rooms, for your hospitality. Thank you, and I believe that you'd now like to say something to us.
I was just going to thank you all for being here. Thank you to our moderator, Archbishop Dew, to our speaker, to Jenny for her thanks. I still like the word trialogue, but not for its classical association, because of its Saxon root, because trying trialogues, the notion of attempt and struggle, but trying also has a Scandinavian sense too, as you probably know, which is trying is wearisome or difficult, and it's both the attempt and the difficulty that we want to convey as well. You've been terribly eloquent about that. But I'd just like to thank you all very much for coming to Victoria this evening, and we hope to see you all again. Thank you.